To the east, to the west, let the baller take you home. Island style represent, to soul to the flow, love your set represent.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh yeah.
Alternative news, analysis and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Clap your hands.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Tuesday Breakfast. It's Tuesday, the 11th of August, 2026. And thank you to the Radioactive Show, 3CR's national program on nuclear peace and energy issues. My name is Fung, and in the studio with me is Julia, and we'll be joined by Juliet later on. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey. Hey, how's it going?
Not too bad. How are you?
Yeah, good. Good. Last night I went to see a film at MIFF the Melbourne International Film Festival. Yes. Have you seen any so far?
I've seen one, but honestly I was kind of late for it. So I saw like most, like three quarters of it.
Was it good?
It was good. It was a documentary about the K3 Annapurna in Nepal.
Oh, okay.
Doing it in winter.
Oh my gosh.
So it was really actually quite intense.
And has that inspired you?
No. Like, not for doing it in winter.
Yeah, yeah.
But one, maybe one day, not in winter. Because doing it in winter seems ridiculous.
No, like, that is terrifying.
What did you see?
I also saw a documentary called Adam's Apple. It is a documentary about growing up as a trans teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And it's filmed, well, your perspective is from the eyes of the teenager himself and his mum. Mm. And it's shot entirely through like home videos.
Wow.
And his mum has filmed everything from his life since he was like 3 or 4, interviewing him. Mm. And so, yeah, it's about transitioning as a young person, and all the personal but also political, social issues that stem from that, but also just what it means to be a teenager in general, and what it means to be a parent and navigating parenting.
Wow.
So, yeah, it was really beautiful.
Yeah, that sounds really good. Mm. Wow, yeah. I would like to see it. Yes, do you recommend? So you recommend?
No, definitely. Yeah, yeah. And the way that they stitched all the different videos together was so beautiful and really well done.
Wow.
So yeah, they often, you know, jump back and forth between when Adam was 3 and then, you know, the so-called present day 15, and then it will jump back to like 4, and then so it keeps moving chronologically into the future but still skipping back into the past when he was a child. So
cool.
Yeah, really, really beautiful. Yeah. Called Adam's Apple. You got plans to see many more?
I have got, I booked a ticket for a movie coming up. It's called Blue Heron.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I saw the trailer for that.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
That looks really interesting.
Yeah, I thought it'd be good, and I love Blue Heron. So I was like,
perfect.
But I want to actually read through the schedule properly and choose a few more.
Yeah. It's a bit daunting, isn't
it? Yes. There's so many.
Every year before me, if I open up the program and then I just open up like hundreds of tabs and just work my way through them.
Yeah.
But it takes some time to, figure out what you want to see.
Exactly. Mm. Yes. Do you have any more that you're seeing as well?
I haven't booked any others. I always love watching the short film packages that they put on, because I just think, it takes so much work and effort and skill to put together a short film in a way that's like, you know, can captivate the audience in something like 9 minutes. Yeah. So hopefully they always sell out though. So I might see if I can make it to one of the short films.
Yes, that would be cool. Yes, because short films are so condensed with so much creativity all at once.
So much, like, yeah. And there's so many really different types of short films, so many different genres. And there are lots of, I guess, emerging directors and storytellers from so-called Australia. So, if any listeners have any recommendations for myth films, you can text us.
Yeah, let us know.
Why not? On 0488809855. We might just give you a brief rundown of what's coming up on today's show. We're starting off with a speech from one of the rallies, Free Palestine, from a couple of weeks ago. We're going to be hearing from Tasneem Samak, who is a Palestinian educator, researcher and organizer with Free Palestine Coalition NAM. At 7:30, we'll be replaying a discussion we had with Lucinda Thorpe from Digital Rights Watch. This was from last month, where we spoke about the Meta AI glasses, and we wanted to replay this in light of recent news that Kmart has come out with its own range of AI glasses.
Yes, and already sold out.
So, so that's coming up at 7:30. At 7:45, we'll be playing a really special conversation that Cleese from Women on the Line had with Deb Welsh, who was the founder of Women on the Line and the program's first producer and presenter. So they speak about what was happening at the time for women in radio and how Women on the Line came to be, and that's to celebrate the 40th anniversary of the program.
At 8 a.m., we'll be listening to a speech from a Free Palestine rally, which took place in Nam on the 2nd of August. It's a speech from Renee Nayef from Students for Palestine and Nat Farah, a community organizer and spoken word poet. And then at 8:15, I'll be interviewing Smriti, who is a friend of mine and an international student from India, to speak with us about the Cockroach Junta Party and the protests occurring in New Delhi, Mumbai and other major cities in India at the moment.
Amazing. That will be such an interesting conversation.
Yes, looking forward to it.
So that's coming up on today's show. We'll be back with the news headlines in just a moment.
Some folks know about it, some don't. No. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty gritty now.
You're listening to 3CR Breakfast, and these are the news headlines for Tuesday, the 11th of August, 2026. Two 12-year-old Aboriginal boys are in hospital with serious injuries after a man allegedly chased and struck them in a ute in Mildura last week, prompting outrage from community members. Andrew Bryan, 57, from Golgol in New South Wales, has been charged with 4 counts of reckless conduct endangering life, dangerous driving causing serious injury, driving in a dangerous manner and or speed, and intentionally causing injury after he allegedly followed the two 12-year-old boys through a pedestrian-only mall in the Victorian town. Both boys were struck and sustained upper body injuries before being hospitalised on Thursday evening. One of the boys was flown to the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne in a serious condition. On social media, Gelang Wild, the Aboriginal new governance structure in Victoria, referenced the incident and said, "Enough is enough. We are deeply concerned about the alleged attack on the two children in Mildura," they wrote. "Our strength and support is with the families and communities in the northwest affected at this time. If you're mob living in Victoria, it's important to take care of each other and reach out for support if you're struggling." The incident was also raised during Melbourne hearings of the Senate inquiry into racism towards First Peoples on Friday.
In other news, last week a worker in West Melbourne Boatyard tragically lost his life in a workplace accident. The 49-year-old man was killed following an explosion while he was welding on the side of a ship. In marine environments, welding and other work-related activities involving high temperatures can be especially risky, especially when involving confined spaces, flammable materials, or gases. The man sustained life-threatening injuries from the accident and died later in hospital. His death is not being treated as suspicious, and a report is currently underway for the coroner. Workplace Victoria will also examine the incident and analyse whether any further action is needed. The worker's death last week marked the 24th workplace fatality in Victoria for 2026. Also in the news, last week the Liberian government announced an end to registration fees for primary school from the new school year starting September 7th this year. The decision will impact hundreds of thousands of children from kindergarten to grade 6, reducing education barriers. A recent Human Rights Watch report from May this year found that 1 in 3 Liberian children had never attended school, and only 1 in 5 completed grade 9. Children living in rural areas and in low-income families have especially faced hardship in accessing education. Many young people have faced delays to starting school, attended irregularly, or were required to take on work to afford to attend school. In order to pay school fees, parents have had to take on debt, skip meals, and make other significant sacrifices. Liberian youth advocate Fennell DeConti-Dewey remarked on the decision to end primary school fees. For Liberian children, removing this key financial barrier is a meaningful step towards making primary education more accessible and equitable for all.
Finally, in the headlines, new research from the Australia Institute demonstrates that the majority of Australians support fairer living and working conditions for Pacific workers. The Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme employs workers from 9 Pacific countries and Timor-Leste across aged care, agriculture and food processing industries. The scheme has been criticised for the modern slavery risk it poses, as these workers are hired by one employer and face poor living and working conditions, underpayment, superannuation issues and difficulty in accessing healthcare. Workers are required to pay large portions of their income to tax, excluded from Medicare, and are barred from changing employers. The poll, which was conducted by YouGov for the Australia Institute, surveyed 2,230 Australians on the conditions of Pacific workers. The data reveals that the majority of Australians support the right of Pacific workers to change employers, including if they are underpaid at 68%, not given sufficient work hours at 78%, or given inadequate or crowded housing at 81%. Two-thirds of Australians believe that workers under the scheme should have access to Medicare. Research manager at the Australia Institute, Morgan Harrington, commented, "Australia depends on these people who spend months away from their families working hard to put food on Australian tables. Australians clearly want these vital workers to be treated fairly. Giving these workers the right to change employers if they're treated badly or giving them access to Medicare is not too much to ask." These have been the news headlines for Tuesday, the 11th of August, 2026. You're listening to 3CR Breakfast on 855 AM.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from so-called Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalisation intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, we're about
feminisms in their multitudes,
First Nations sovereignty,
land back,
trans liberation, poo-poo on the turfs,
abolition,
anti-racism,
sex worker rights,
staff liberation,
disability justice,
anti-imperialism,
decolonisation,
an end to borders,
workers' justice,
and so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
You're listening to 3CR Breakfast, and we're now joined by Juliet in the studio as well. Good morning. How are you this morning?
I'm okay. Yeah, have survived the blackout last night. I don't know. I don't think either of you guys experienced it. I think it was in the inner north for about 2.5 hours. So, yeah.
But everything's all good now.
Everything's all good. Okay. And my housemate decided to fix a bunch of light bulbs during the blackout. So when the lights turned back on, they didn't just turn back on. Like, the whole house was lit
up.
So, and they were like, did you notice it's different in here? And I was like, wait, what's going on? All I can tell is that we have light now. But we had a lot more light.
A lot more light, yeah. What a way to come back. Exactly. From a blackout.
Yes.
Okay, well, this morning we are starting today's show with a speech from the Free Palestine rally that took place outside the State Library in Naam on Sunday, the 2nd of August 2026. Tasneem Samak is a Palestinian woman, educator, researcher, and organizer with Free Palestine Coalition Naam. In her speech, Tasneem spoke about the rise of the far right and how it is impacting the struggle for a free Palestine, Israel's continued and increased aggression against Palestine, Lebanon, and Iran, and the urgent need for united organizing. In the following excerpt, she is being introduced by Renee Nayef.
So I'm going to introduce our next speaker, who's been one of the organizers, the lead organizers of this historic movement across the country for justice and liberation, Tasneem Samak. She's a Palestinian woman. I'm an organizer with Free Palestine Coalition.
I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and pay my respect to elders past and present. Always was, always will be.
Aboriginal land.
Always was, always will be.
Aboriginal land.
As we're hearing from all the speakers today, we are living through a very critical moment with the rise of the far right, and that has led to repercussions for Gaza, but that is also leading to repercussions for all oppressed people around the world. And it's a time for us to be really serious about what we're facing. We're facing a brutal enemy, and that is the situation in Gaza. And we've lived to see the way that a lack of solidarity can lead to exactly the kind of outcomes for the Palestinian people as we are living through now. So that's the first point that I wanted to make, that when we read the news coming out of Palestine with attacks on the West Bank, with a very subjugating deals being made on behalf of the Palestinian people in Gaza, when we're looking at the occupation of Lebanon that looks like it's going to be a permanent occupation of Lebanon, and when we look at the US-Israeli war on Iran, Iran, a sovereign people and a sovereign state, then that makes us question, really, how do we arrive at change? And we've attempted that by coming out to these protests week in and week out. But we've also set the bar, I think, correctly by saying that there should be sanctions. There should be a boycott, sanction, and divestment movement. So the absence of sanctions, the absence of divestment, the absence of a real economic material impact has meant that Israel has executed this genocide and is expanding its war through Zionist occupation, but of course with US imperialist support, to degrade and subjugate the rights of people in the region. So this is something we could foresee. This is why we have argued for sanctions, but we've also seen that argument is not enough. And that brings us to organizing. So when we organize, we see results, and it's a time of struggle. We don't really have options. The time of appeals, the times of asking nicely are over, and they've been over. We're looking at the degradation of Indigenous rights around the world, an increase in deaths in custody rather than a decrease, an increase in youth Indigenous incarceration rather than a decrease. And this is how it's going to be. We've seen the ICE regime. That's an escalation. So the advance of the far right, the advance of fascism, has meant serious negative impacts that will continue to go in that direction until they are met with an equal and organized force. That's how it is. I know we don't like to say that. I know we don't like to admit that. But when we actually face it and we admit it, then we see really what is this asking of us? How do we struggle against a nuclear power? How do we struggle? How do we, civilians, stand our ground? And I take inspiration from struggles in the past, such as the anti-slavery struggle, where, you know, for centuries, black people were enslaved by the white masters. And they liberated themselves, and we got to a point of abolishing slavery. And I say this to my students as well in my classroom, that when we're looking at racial progress, let's not forget, right? Let's not forget that slavery was legal. Let's not forget that colonization was the discourse of the time, that it was promoted, that it was sponsored, that it was endorsed and actively celebrated. In this nation here, founded by settler colonialism, this is a white nation that celebrated itself as white for over a century. All the way to 1975 did we abolish white Australia. Not long ago. And so the remnants of that world order is what is facing us now. The task wasn't complete. It's on us to complete it, to take it to the next step, and to commit ourselves to that. So I really appreciate all of us being here, but we really need to be serious about what it's going to take. And I'm heartbroken to see the people of Gaza having to disarm, okay? Because that disarmament comes from a position of subjugation. The people who are occupied have the right to raise arms against the occupation by international law. The people who are oppressed have the right to face their oppressor, to resist their oppressor, and to fight back against their oppressor. We need to look to the workers' movement for struggle. The workers' movement that brought us Medicare, right, when people were dying because they couldn't afford hospitals. The workers' movement that developed workers' rights because people were dying because they weren't given fair wage and shifts. Let's fight against genocides, first of all. And I really appreciate the strikes that are going on, the teacher strikes, the nurses strikes, the council workers. But we put the bar really high, maybe, when we said, let's strike for Palestine, let's shut it down for Palestine, let's sanction Israel. And the absence of these sanctions, the absence of these sanctions is over 60,000 deaths of my people and my family's blood and my family being under the rubble. So when I talk to the workers' movement, I have an urgent call and I would like to see it met. I would like to see the workers' movement organize for international struggle the way that all fascist regimes would fall, the way that the Nazis were defeated, and the way that Israel should be defeated. And down with the Zionist regime, down with US empire, down with capitalism, down with imperialism, and free, free Palestine. Free, free Palestine.
Free, free Palestine.
Long live the resistance.
Long live the resistance.
Long live the resistance.
Long live the resistance.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tasneem.
You're listening to 3CR, and that was Tasneem Samak, Palestinian educator, researcher and organizer with Free Palestine Coalition NAM, speaking at the Free Palestine Rally on 2nd of August 2026. Stay tuned, because later in the program at 8 a.m. we'll be playing another speech from that rally. We'll be hearing from Nat Farah.
Via to an array of modern designs. Explore the range and order online or drop by 3CR during business hours. We're your support for the rights of Palestinians. Go to kufiyas.org.au. That's kufiyas.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
They're eyeing off an estate which is in perfectly good condition. It just happens to have bay views and a lot of open space.
Bay Views for All is a new documentary that reveals the human cost of the Victorian government's public housing redevelopment project. The film documents residents of the Barrack Beacon public housing estate as they fight to save their homes and community. Bay Views for All is available for community members, public housing advocates, and organisations to screen, intending to spark conversations, raise funds, and educate audiences on the importance of public housing. To organise a screening, email barrackbeacon@gmail.com. That's BARAKBEACON @gmail.com.
Save public housing! Stop the demolition!
A 3CR supporter.
It's time to do your census. Hearing from everyone helps to plan for the future of our communities. You can do it online, on paper, or with help from the Census team. In the Census, every answer matters. Visit census.abs.gov.au or call 1800 181 227 for information and support. Authorised by the Australian Bureau of Statistics, Canberra.
A 3CR supporter.
Hi, my name is Miss Kinnan. I'm a proud Yodiyoda, Jajarong, Kalkadoon and Yirrindali Aboriginal Sovereign Woman. And you're listening to 3CR, guys. Check in with your friends. Make sure you guys are going good. And also stick up for what's right, yeah? Free Palestine.
You're listening to 3CR Breakfast on 855 AM 3CR Digital and on 3cr.org.au. And before these messages, we heard the song Stick of Gum by Nemesis. Last week, it was reported that Kmart's line of smart glasses sold out after their release on 28th of July. On Friday, the Attorney General, Michelle Rowland, appealed to Australia's Office of the Australian Information Commissioner, or OAIC, to investigate the potential privacy implications of smart glasses. This morning, we'd like to revisit a conversation we had with Lucinda Thorpe, privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch, about surveillance technology and the Meta targeting its marketing of its AI glasses towards young women. This interview aired on Tuesday Breakfast on 7th of July 2026. Meta's latest AI glasses, a collaborative project with Kylie Jenner, has been met with backlash, with concerns raised about the normalization of surveillance technology, the use of celebrity endorsement to market this product to young women, and the increasing dangers to personal privacy and safety. Here to unpack this kind of AI technology is Lucinda Thorpe, privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch. Welcome back to 3CR, Lucinda.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you so much. I remember contacting you straight away when I was getting all of this information online about these glasses. So I really appreciate your time this morning. So as I said, Meta has just launched their latest so-called smart glasses in collaboration with Kylie Jenner. And understandably, there has been a lot of backlash in response to this, especially in the way that this wearable technology has been marketed. Can you explain to listeners how these glasses work and their purported functions?
Yeah, so the users will wear the glasses, and the glasses have built-in cameras just kind of like in the frame near the lens. They also have microphones and speakers. So when users say, "Hey Meta," the microphone in the glasses actually picks up on it and Meta's AI is activated. This means the glasses are always listening and waiting for their "Hey Meta" cue. The AI can translate, answer questions, both general questions and questions about their environment. So the AI can actually connect to the camera and scan the environment, which is crazy. The camera feature is where a lot of these privacy concerns come in. There's been at least two class actions filed because users were unaware that human Meta workers would review footage from their glasses, including, you know, really intimate moments of, like them going to the bathroom and stuff, things that you would not want to be filmed and shared. Users were unaware that the footage would be reviewed by a human, and in one of the class actions, they were unaware that that footage had even been taken.
That is very terrifying. Everyone in the studio right now was making facial expressions listening to you talk about that just now. It's incredibly scary that those glasses are always listening and always watching. We've spoken before about surveillance technology, in terms of like facial recognition technology, things in supermarkets, CCTV cameras. And we've spoken specifically about the dangers that women especially would face And when we're talking about smart glasses, this is them being covertly photographed or filmed by potential abusers or stalkers. Are there any current laws or policies that exist in Australia that would protect civilians from being filmed with smart glasses?
Yes and no. So the Surveillance Devices Act is a Victorian piece of legislation which regulates how they can be used. However, there are states which are left unprotected without similar legislation. But in Victoria, the Surveillance Devices Act restricts the actions individuals can take to publish or communicate private conversations or activities recorded with Meta glasses. The maximum penalty for this is 2 years, but I don't know of any cases where such charges have actually been made. This is, of course, not to say that it's not happening. It's just that, you know, the police probably aren't investigating it to the best of their ability and the courts aren't equipped to, you know, prosecute these kinds of cases. Yeah. You can also sue someone for invading your privacy. In order to do this, you need to prove that someone has misused your personal information, which could include, like, your image or breached your seclusion. You must also prove that you had a reasonable expectation of privacy and the breach of privacy is reckless or serious. So the privacy tour hasn't been used yet, but it looks like it could be a promising avenue for compensation for people who've been covertly filmed during intimate moments by abusive partners. However, a lot of the Meta glasses content is men talking to random women in public and trying to hit on them. Yeah. For these women, the privacy tour could actually be a less accessible route of compensation because the recording is taking place in a completely public place and the expectation of privacy, it's still there. You're not expecting to be filmed, but it's less explicit than, say, in the bedroom. Mm. But, you know, this is all yet to be tested in court.
Yeah. Thank you for that, Lucinda. And I'm sure there will be more information that comes out about this in the future. Early this year, following a Wired report that revealed Meta had quietly embedded facial recognition technology that they have been calling NameTag for its smart glasses into an app downloaded to millions of phones, this code was then removed, with Meta claiming that no final decision had been made. Wired reported that three AI models were found to be powering this technology called NameTag, one model to detect people's faces, one to crop them, and one to encode them into biometric data. Beyond the dangers of individuals capturing and using images and videos of others, what do we need to know about tech companies like Meta who are collecting, storing, and possibly exploiting this data?
So once you add facial recognition, Meta glasses can identify people and turn their faces into this biometric data. And that creates like a massive surveillance issue. So they could potentially track where people are, where they were last seen, and who they were with. At scale, millions of these smart glasses could become like a kind of distributed surveillance network. And the people being captured may have never bought a Meta product, agreed to its terms or consented to having their face turned into data. So this data would be enormously valuable to advertisers, police, intelligence agencies and governments. I mean, you can imagine an authoritarian government asking Meta, have you seen this person? Where were they last seen? Who were they with? Now, right now, there could be like legal or technical limits on that. But Meta has consistently kissed the ring of authoritarian governments. Mm. And we shouldn't be relying on Meta's goodwill. It's a company that has a long record of treating privacy as secondary to profit. You know, it's bragged about identifying feelings of worthlessness in Australian teenagers so that it could advertise and target them. It failed catastrophically in Myanmar, where hate against the Rohingya spread across its platform to the point of a full-scale genocide. I don't believe that this is a company we should be trusting with such powerful technology. But, you know, it's not just about Meta. The real question is, you know, whether any private company should be allowed to collect, store and exploit biometric data from people who have just never consented to it in the first place.
Mm. Thank you for that, Lucinda. And in researching for this interview today, I was reading an article on Countercurrents by Asmi Gupto, who opened their article on these glasses with the following statement. Meta's newest AI-powered eyewear, co-designed with Kylie Jenner and marketed under the name Starfire, is a useful case study in how a consumer product can extend a system of data extraction without ever appearing political, and in how celebrity endorsement functions as the mechanism that renders this extension palatable. To end our conversation today, Lucinda, how do you see celebrity endorsements like this actively minimising and normalising surveillance?
Look, it's a really great question, and I think that it is quite insidious of these companies to reach out to, you know, influencers and present this really dangerous technology as something which is kind of just like trendy and yeah, completely normal. You know, in this case, Kylie Jenner's audience is made up largely of young women and girls who are among the people who are most vulnerable to covert filming, image-based abuse and unwanted surveillance. So there's something really troubling about using a woman with that level of influence to build trust in a product that could expose their audience to greater risk. I think, for me, the encouraging part, you know, the silver lining is that Meta's marketing focus on women and girls indicates that women and girls haven't bought their previous marketing. They've seen through it. And they're questioning the technology and recognizing the dangers and pushing back against the idea that constant recording should become normal. So I'm hoping that continues and they're able to see through this promotion.
That was a conversation that I had with Lucinda Thorpe from Digital Rights Watch last month on Meta's AI glasses and using celebrity Kylie Jenner to market its surveillance tech to young women. We hope to continue this conversation about the increased pervasiveness of surveillance technology and the urgent need for regulation as these products are made more accessible to the public.
Next up, we have a song by Nabi, who is a Korean-Australian artist, producer and DJ, blending hyperpop and trance to create emotional, euphoric dance music. In June, she performed at the Electronic Musicians Against AI fundraiser, supporting Digital Rights Watch. This is her song, In My Room. That was the song, In My Room, by Nabi.
And up next, to celebrate Women on the Line's 40th anniversary, Cleese spoke to the program's first presenter and producer, Deb Welch, about the inception of the show and what was happening at the time for women in radio. In the following segment, you'll hear conversations between Cleese and Deb, as well as excerpts from the first episode of Women on the Line, which first aired on July 16th. 1986. To listen back to the full conversation, you can go to 3cr.org/womenontheline.
The first episode of Women on the Line was broadcast on July 16, 1986. This week on the program, we mark 40 years of Women on the Line with an interview with Wattle's first producer, Deb Welch. We'll also hear some archival excerpts from the very first episode of the show. Let's hear from Deb now, I opened our conversation by asking her why Women on the Line began.
There was a survey done in the community broadcasting sector, which was pretty young at the time, and it identified something like 75% of the on-air presenters in the sector across the country were men, and only 25% were women, and vice versa, not surprisingly, doing the admin and off-air tasks, 75% were women and 25% were men. So 3CR, being the type of station that it is, resolved immediately to do something practical about that problem. So they got some funding to employ a woman to be both a women's coordinator and to produce a national women's current affairs program. And I was a volunteer at the time and got the job. So it was really about 3CR taking the lead when they identified disparity in gender involvement and things, and probably to this day still the only role with that function in broadcasting that I've ever heard of.
Yeah, absolutely. And so interesting that core aspect of the program has remained. I find it fascinating they were able to do a survey. I feel like even now data collection around gender parity is a bit thin on the ground in the community broadcasting sector.
Well, so, you know, there's a funny thing with technology that actually people often used to be able to do things better without it, because they just send out a survey and people were used to sending things back because they weren't overloaded.
Yes, not 400,000 things competing for your attention. And when you started the program, what was, I guess, the brief for what kind of issues you would cover?
Not much of a brief. And, you know, what did women's current affairs mean? There was a whole context of the feminist movement, and every community radio station, even ones in kind of regional and rural areas, which were starting up at that time, they all had a women's program. This was a thing. And they were all trying to redefine, not just current affairs, they were sort of trying to give a voice to women who had generally not been leaders in the public conversation, in the town, in the city, in the country. And so there was a lot of sort of fishing around to know what that meant or what that looked like. And for a while there was a sort of tendency to do something like women and cats, or, you know, women and everything, as if there was a women's perspective on things that was sort of a perspective.
Wow.
And as we all know now, women have as diverse perspectives on things as any other group of people that you would get. But what it was trying to get to is, if we're going to talk about things differently, what does that look and feel like? So I think sort of fairly early on, I took the view that it was about current affairs, but the people talking about it were women. And that took enough effort to not go to the usual go-to people who were mostly men, but find new voices who were women to talk about anything, anything. So I would say that aim of actually bringing women in to be the spokespeople or to be the expert or to be the person with a strong opinion. That was the kind of stronger element of it, and the topics and content were anything.
I'm finding this so extremely reassuring, because that is actually my understanding of the program brief to a T almost. And so I think it's actually so interesting that that has lasted the span of 40 years. So before we go any further, I would like to play you this. So get ready.
Okay.
Part one of the very first Women on the Line, the National Women's News and Current Affairs Program. Producer is Deb Welsh, and the tape starts in 5 seconds. Hello and welcome to the very first edition of Women on the Line, the national program of women's news and current affairs. I'm Deb Welsh from 3CR in Melbourne, and you'll be hearing myself and other women from public radio stations around Australia on this program.
If you couldn't hear us in the background, Deb and I were both having a little laugh. Then at the incredible theme music is so excellent. Actually, I think it's really well selected. How did you choose that?
I don't remember. I don't remember now. And you know, as I don't know, is my voice several octaves deeper or?
I think you sound excellent on the old program. And yeah, it's so interesting listening to your own voice, and I can only imagine as years change. We were saying before today's interview that in my first shows I sound so high-pitched and tentative, which I think my voice has changed a bit too. Just I've been doing the show for about 9 years now.
That is the thing about getting the voice. Because if I can just tell you a little story about the first time I came into the studio.
Yes, please.
I was working at the Young Women's Housing Collective. We were trying to resolve issues for young women who are homeless, because the whole homelessness sector, shelters and youth refuges, were all kind of assuming everyone was a boy in those days. And we came in to do an interview with my boss at the time, and who was probably like 5 years older than me, but to me seemed like, you know, very mature. And they put these two big mics in front of us, and it was all very intimidating. I'd never done anything like that before. And I remember thinking I couldn't move one bit away from the mic. I had to stay very, very still. But my boss, who was with me, really froze. She was more nervous than me. And it was so kind of unbearable that I just started talking because somebody kind of had to step in. And anyway, I came out of that interview kind of a little bit pleased with myself, because I thought, I'm not bad at this, you know, talking on radio business. And then the next thing that happened was that a message went round all the community groups. And in that era, the community groups were all in Collingwood Fitzroy because it was cheap to live here. Very different. And seeking people from activist community organisations to come and do a training course.
So exciting.
I just thought, you know, I'm not bad at this radio stuff, from my massive experience. and so I thought, oh, I'll go along to that. And I was here in this studio for seriously 20 minutes and I thought, I love this.
That's amazing.
I love it. You know, everything about it.
Let's hear some more from the very first episode of Women on the Line. This is Deb speaking with 3CR's Claire Thompson about what the program will be.
So it's women's news and current affairs. What sort of things will you be looking for?
Well, we'll be covering women's industrial issues, women's health issues, avoiding the mentality, though, of relegating things to just being women's issues, because I think that somehow absolves everybody else of any responsibility of taking them up or making an issue out of things. So I'll be working from the perspective that I think women define news a bit more broadly than men do, that they take some account of their personal lives as well as the broader political sphere. So we'll be involving both of those things on the cassette, as far as I can see it at the moment. There'll be a lot of issues on it that don't get taken up unless women take them up, and things such as childcare is a classic example. In the end, women end up having to take on the responsibility for childcare, and so in the end, women take it up as an issue as well. And also, a lot of issues that are not issues for men in anything like the same sense that they are issues for women. And these are things, I think, that affect women's lives personally because of power imbalances between men and women, and often things that are beneficial to men are to the detriment of women, and so it's going to be women who take them up too. And I'm thinking of things here like the reproductive technology debate that's going on at the moment.
Women on the Line.
I just find it really fascinating what you said about the particular community stations in different towns or areas all having a women's program, but perhaps not having like the political understanding to fully realise the potential of that, or knowing that there was sort of a gap to be filled, but like what did it mean? Or, you know, women's issues perhaps not being always women's issues, even that phrase.
Yeah, but what they also often had, they were often quite feisty feminists, but living in a regional area. And so they did not have necessarily a supportive environment like 3CR, where of course you could come in and of course you're a feminist and of course you're going to talk about those things and you could be a bit stroppy if you liked. So they were often dealing with more opposition, bit of hostility, all of that sort of stuff, fighting for their space in that local station. And So the role also had a support function for all of those women in those different stations so that they weren't isolated just fighting their own little fight, but that we were kind of networking together among ourselves. And that was that contribution from women in stations around the country was in order to get them to do their interviews locally, it to come to here and us to put it and share it back out to them so they could share their content around and kind of, you know, just a networking strength, solidarity sort of activity. They'd send it to me on a cassette just to get the content. They'd post it to me on a cassette. I would dub the cassette onto a reel-to-reel tape, edit it, edit the interview, make the program, and then copy the program onto, I think I remember, something like about 25 cassettes a week that I hand-labelled. We had a 1-to-4 cassette copier. Copy them, you know, that was one day sort of just running them through, putting the labels on, hand-filling in the details on the label and putting them in padded post bags and walking up to the Collingwood post office and sticking them in the mail.
And in this next segment, we're going to hear a speech from the Free Palestine rally, which took place in Naam on the 2nd of August, continuing on from the segment we played earlier in the show. So we're going to hear from Renee Nayef, who's from Students for Palestine, and Nat Farah, a community organiser and spoken word poet who addressed the crowd in this recording. Farah speaks about the recent convergence on Pine Gap, in which 600 people gathered in Mabantwa, Alice Springs, and to protest Pine Gap. And she also discusses the role of Pine Gap in US militarism and how that connects to Palestine. And we also hear about the action which brought activists the closest to Pine Gap in 50 years. Here is that clip.
All right, thank you so much, everybody, for coming out tonight. Today, everybody should be proud of continuing to come out to stand here on these steps in solidarity with the Palestinians, with the Lebanese people, with the Iranians under Israel's bombs, facing Israel's genocide, experiencing settler violence, campaigns of terror in the West Bank, simply for being born in a region that our imperialist politicians, the people who run our world, want to occupy, want to invade, and want to pillage. Shame. So we're here today to stand with those people. My name is Renee. I'm one of the conveners of Students for Palestine here in Victoria. I'm a Lebanese woman from the south of Lebanon, from Sur, a village in the south who has resisted against Israel's violence, not just this time, not just during this war, but for decades and decades. And right now, as Israel continues its genocide, 3 years, more than 1,000 days of bombs, of starvation, of so-called ceasefire. That's what our politicians call what's going on right now. They call it a ceasefire. Shame. But we're going to hear from speakers today, people who have been part of our historic movement for justice, for liberation for the past 3 years here in Naam, but also people who have seen that violence firsthand, who have been part of that resistance. So I'm going to pass it back over to Moaya to introduce our first speaker for today. But everybody, listen to the speeches. Congratulate yourselves for continuing to come out and get ready to march, to take to the streets for a free Palestine.
Free, free Palestine.
Hey, good afternoon, everyone. Going to take a second to acknowledge where we are. So we are standing on the Wurundjeri and the Boonwurrung lands. This land was stolen. Sovereignty of these lands were never ceded. They were never surrendered. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land. This always was and always will be The genocide against First Peoples continues today. Just 2-3 days ago, we heard of yet another death in custody right here in Melbourne at a facility called DPFS. Absolute shame on the prison industrial system. It continues to genocide First Nations people. But our struggles are interlinked. I'm here to tell you about actually a very beautiful thing that happened recently. Today you're going to hear from people who have experienced so much violence and have seen it firsthand, and so have I as well. I come from Syria. My parents are from lineage of Palestine and Armenia, and we've seen genocide so much. But today, while the Palestine flag is hugging me from behind, I wanted to share with you a story of inspiration and motivation and something beautiful that happened. And so from July 18th to the 20th, 600 people from across the continent traveled Pine Gap. 600 people from all over made their way to Alice Springs, to Mbantwa, to protest and to disrupt the Pine Gap US intelligence facility. Do people know what Pine Gap is? Pine Gap is basically a US Army base where intelligence is gathered, and it is delivered directly to the US Army and then their allies, which is, you know, Israel. So basically every time there's a drone or a missile or a bomb or a fighter jet, it is getting that information from Pine Gap. Pine Gap makes us complicit in genocide in Palestine. It makes us an active participant in what is happening there. And it sits at the crux of the US-Australia alliance, which basically makes us a target as well. That's why 600 of us made it all the way there to protest this in the biggest protest at Pine Gap since 1987. It's an absolute full showcase of solidarity. And not only was it, you know, random people, there were people from campaigns across the continent, from groups that have started because of what's happening in Palestine, groups that have been going for decades, or groups that started a week ago, all of us sharing what our work is and networking. And we've all decided that we want to have a national network that is focusing on anti-militarism and breaking the US-Australia alliance and putting Palestine at the heart of that as well. What was so beautiful about what happened at Pine Gap is that it was all led by this family called the Hayes family, and they're Aranda. So they are the rightful custodians of the land, of the sacred site of Pine Gap, that is a man's site to the Aranda people. And as we marched to Pine Gap, the closest that anyone has gotten in over 50 years, there was a police line in front of us. And the Hayes family, because they were supported by so many of us, were able to go through the police lines to deliver their letter to ASIO, to the CIA, to any people who exist at the Pine Gap facility. And I wanted to read a very heart-wrenching part of that letter that just shows their incredible generosity. We don't want to be feeling guilty all the time when there's bad things happening overseas to little ones. We're not the ones controlling the facility, but we feel guilty because it's coming from our land. We feel sorry for the little ones, the families, men, women, children, old people overseas and in Gaza and other places who are getting killed by the base. When the struggles of Palestinians and First Nations people are deeply linked and they're rooted in Indigenous sovereignty and land back. I wanted to finish by talking about media coverage of this convergence. We already know that the media is Zionist. I think that's pretty clear to everyone by now. And even the media that is anti-Semitic at the moment, like the ABC, are still very much controlled by the Zionist lobby. And so while the ABC actually covered the convergence, they literally didn't talk about Palestine. They stopped us talking,
We mentioned the IDF. They even stopped the video of Auntie Felicity speaking when she started to speak about Gaza. And they made it just an Indigenous issue. And it is not just an Indigenous issue. This relates to Australia being complicit in overseas crimes. And I think it's really important that we start to properly look at Australia's complicity in what is happening. And that is through the Pine Gap facility, through AUKUS, which is costing us billions of dollars that could be going to schools and hospitals. And it's also in militarism and expanded militarism and in weapons. And so this is what I want to kind of finish with, is that that was a beautiful example of what happens when we come together and put our differences aside, because let's not kid ourselves, the left is sectarian. And it is so divided. But we can put these differences on the side, we can come together, and really beautiful things can happen. And this is how we continue to organize to sow the seeds that are needed for the long long-term resistance that we truly need, so that we can set Palestine free, so that we can set this continent free, so that we can all have a better world for all of us together. So let's keep organizing and let's keep showing up, because we have a world to win. We'll just do a chant that's "From the river to the sea, always was, always will be." Is that cool? Okay. From the river to the sea, always was, always will be. Always was, always will be.
Okay. That was Nat Farah speaking at the Free Palestine Rally in Naam on the 2nd of August. Farah discussed the recent convergence on Pine Gap in Mbantwa, how it brought together activists across the country against US militarism, and Pine Gap's role in the genocide in Palestine.
Next up, we have an interview with Smriti, who is an international student from India, here to speak with me today about the Cockroach Junta Party and the protests occurring in New Delhi, Mumbai, and other major Indian cities. The CJP is a satirical yet people-power-fueled party that has been described by its founder as a political party for the people the system forgot to count. The CJP party formed as a result of millions of students in India's frustration with the medical exam paper leaks, critiquing the education system of India. The name was generated after the now resigned Indian Education Minister, Dharminder Pradhan, compared the country's unemployed youth to parasites and cockroaches. Hi, Smriti, how are you going?
I am good. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for coming on the show today to speak with me.
I'm honoured, to be honest.
Oh, awesome. No, thank you so much
for having me.
No worries at all. My first question today is, why has the education system failed these students of India, which has triggered these protests?
To be honest, I don't think the education, I think the biggest problem with the education system is that it has become more focused on the competition than education. Mm-hmm. Like, there are movies that are being made about it, and in all of it, they all describe the education system as it being a rat race. Mm. From a very young age, students are like thought that their worth is connected to the marks, their ranks, and eventually their salary. We have like millions of students competing for a very limited number of seats and jobs. So while the quality of education and opportunities are available to them, but what is offered after the education system is not guaranteed at all.
Yeah.
And the system doesn't reward them for their like curiosity or their own creativity or what they think, their thoughts. They just curate them based on whatever they can memorize.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I have heard that, yeah, it's very competitive, especially with the medical exam. As a result, these protests have occurred across India. So Why do you think these protests have gathered so many students, specifically with the medical exam, and why do you think they're getting so much support within India and across the world?
So I think that NEET was the breaking point for all the students in India, because a lot of people are aspiring to become doctors and engineers, and there's just one exam to get them through that. So if they fail it, then it's just all over. So, you know, their entire potential is measured through one exam. And you can have one student studying in, like, a well-funded school with access to expensive coaching, private tutors, and everything. And then there's another student who can't afford that, who can't go to school every single day, who works and is, like, meeting ends through that. So after doing all of this, the entire exam is being compromised. And for someone who can't attempt it again, who doesn't have the money to attempt it again, has just lost everything. So in like 2026, they registered a CBI complaint to check into the paper leaks. They told that whoever leaked the paper was arrested. But then when the re-exam occurred, the papers were leaked again. That's what was found. So imagine studying for an entire year or even 2-3 years, because a lot of people, after their junior college education, they take gaps to study for NEET exams. And imagine studying all those years and then knowing that the exam itself is compromised. The integrity of the exam is compromised. What are you going to do after that?
Yeah.
It was the breaking point. And then everybody just got together. And the CJP was like a huge, huge contributor to that. I think CJP is the one that got them together.
Yeah, that's so important, because, yeah, it is very unfair that this leak, these leaks of the medical exam have occurred. And it's, yeah, it just, you're exactly right, it creates much hardship for those students who, yeah, spend so much money and time and effort for this exam and put, you know, their whole life on hold for it, only for it to be leaked. It's just, yeah, not right. So, yeah, it is, I think, so cool that these students have been able to have access to an outlet to be able to express their frustration. I know that part of the CJP's sort of like campaign is basically saying that they're representing the youth that the right-wing government of Narendra Modi's party sort of criticizes for being lazy or unemployed. Is unemployment a major issue for the youth in India? And yeah, what? Tell me more about this.
Okay. What I think is, I do think unemployment is a huge issue in India, and it is directly connected to the whole education system failing them. You know, so the problem isn't that someone doesn't really have a job. It's that young people spend years getting educated, collecting degrees and qualifications, and then they discover that there aren't good enough jobs actually waiting for them. So, and when people are employed, there's the issue of underemployment, where you're working jobs and that doesn't really use their education or their skills. So that really puts the whole question of, do I really need to study in there, right? So, yeah, the youth unemployment isn't just an economic problem, but I think it's a huge social problem as well. And the entire way that the education is designed to, you know, just make them read, learn, and, what do you say, vomit out things that they just learned and not actually testing them for their own knowledge. That's why.
Yes, it's like a systemic issue. And that's why I think, the CGFP is doing a great job at, like, sort of, giving these people, like, a voice and empowerment as well. How is the issue being covered in India? I know that I've heard that mainstream media is not really covering it. Could you tell me more about that?
So, actually, I can't say that they're completely ignoring it because some outlets are covering the protest.
Oh, yeah.
But the serious problem is that these issues aren't getting much attention as the other political issues would.
Mm-hmm.
So the media has, like, a huge influence over what becomes the national conversation. That's what we know. So if a young person is protesting and an exam leak gets 5 minutes of coverage while political drama or celebrity controversy gets ours, that actually tells us where and what becomes newsworthy in India. And that's really, really sad, to be honest. But there's a structural reason for it, is what I think. It's the whole idea about media ownership, advertising. And there's a lot of political pressure and, you know, the competing and the rating for economic news. In India, I think a lot of things work with political pressure. And that's why social media has become, like, a huge, huge factor in spreading the news about the protest. Even I got to know so many things about it. It's bizarre out there. It was bizarre. People were coming dressed as Marvel characters in the morning and then asking for their rights in the evening. But I think that's how the generation today is there. They can be completely, completely out of the base, but serious at the same time.
I think there's been so much coverage online, which has kind of helped the world know about this issue and raise awareness. So I guess that's definitely a benefit of this sort of social media, I guess, being able to see what's going on. I think that might be all we have time for. But thank you so much for sharing with us. Smriti, and I'll definitely be keeping tabs on what else happens with the protests, and hopefully it keeps having this definitely, like, social impact. And thank you.
Thank you so much, Julia. Thank you for having me.
No worries.
Bye-bye.
We were speaking with Smriti about the Cockroach Junta Party and the protests occurring across major cities in India that are critiquing the medical exam and its leaks and how it's affected students across India. You're listening to 3CR.
Thank you so much, Julia. And now we're going to chat through some events that are happening this week. So on Thursday, 13th of August at 2 p.m., there's going to be the Students Against Hanson rally taking place at the State Library of Victoria. Then on Friday, 14th of August at 4:30 p.m., there's a protest, Healthcare Workers Won't Be Silenced, taking place outside the APRA office on 222 Lonsdale Street in the CBD. And finally, on Sunday, the 16th of August at midday, there is the Unite Against Racism rally taking place at the Dandenong Market. We've had a really massive show today. So a quick rundown. We started off at 7:15 with a speech from the Free Palestine rally from the 2nd of August. We heard from Tasnim Samak, a Palestinian woman, educator, researcher and organizer, who spoke about the rise of the far right and how it's impacting the struggle for a free Palestine, as well as increased aggression against Palestine, Lebanon and Iran and the need for united organizing. Then at 7:30, We heard an interview that Fung had last month with Lucinda Thorpe, privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch, talking about surveillance technology and Meta's targeting of marketing AI glasses towards young women. And this is following last week's news that Kmart's line of smart glasses had sold out after being released on the 28th of July. And then at 7:45, we heard a conversation celebrating Women on the Line's 40th anniversary, in which Cleese spoke to the program's first producer and presenter, Deb Welch, about the inception of the show and what was happening at that time for women in radio. And then at 8 o'clock, we heard another speech from the August 2nd Free Palestine rally. We heard from Nat Farah, a community organiser and spoken word poet, who spoke about the recent convergence on Pine Gap, in which 600 people gathered in Mapantua to protest Pine Gap. And she also discussed the role of Pine Gap in US militarism and how that impacts Palestine as well.
And then at 8:15, we spoke with Smriti, who was here to speak with us about the cockroach junta party and the protests occurring over India, over the criticising the education system in India.
And yeah, that was our show for today, Tuesday, the 11th of August. You're listening to 3CR and this has been Tuesday Breakfast. Up next is going to be Accent of Women, so stay tuned and we'll be back next week with our next show. But thank you for listening.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.